You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, December 5th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Tithi Bhattacharya, professor of Southeast Asian history at Purdue University, author of Social Reproduction Theory, Remapping Class, Recentering Oppression. Meanwhile, Republican tax bill goes to conference. Supposedly, two Senate promises that may cause the House concern, but don't hold your breath. Renew reporting shows Mike Pence made his move. And when you go after the king and you miss, you end up being his vice president, I guess.
Prayers didn't work, huh, Mike?
Meanwhile, Roy Moore's I'm Not a Child Predator defense collapses. RNC boldly announces they'll support him again now. White House plans a private spy force. I'll say that again. White House plans its own private spy force to compete with the rest of our intelligence community.
It's the new plumbers.
Robert Mueller subpoenas Trump's Deutsche Bank records. SCOTUS says Texas can curb gay rights. Conyers resigns and endorses his son. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Hello, folks. Welcome to the show. Some of you are probably here for the first time. And if you are, then welcome. I suspect you may have heard the news. MSNBC have decided, or I should say MSNBC and I have decided to part ways based upon their firing me from their network. Therefore, I decided not to go there anymore. I've got, we're going to talk a lot more about it. Eric Wemple, at the Washington Post has written a piece that, at least covers some of the TikTok, as it were. I mean, look, I have said on this program for a couple of days, I wasn't sure of what my situation was at MSNBC. I have voicemails that we'll play maybe later that might be fun. But the long and short of it is that Mike Mike Cernovich. Okay, Mike. However you pronounce that. I guess there's a theta at the end. He willfully misinterpreted a tweet that I did. Obviously, you can see the only people who seem to agree with his interpretation are David Duke. That's not a coincidence, of course. Mike Cernovich is very white supremacy friendly. He certainly has articulated that in tweets. He is, look, and by his own reckoning, he is a very famous, well-known person. He's very famous and well-known. He's tweeted that out. I think we can all acknowledge that.
Super well-known.
He's known for Pizzagate. But some people, like, for instance, Michael didn't even know that he had been charged with rape and then apparently pled it down to a battery misdemeanor.
I plead the fifth.
Yeah, Michael didn't know that.
I didn't even know that.
Some people like, Jamie was like, oh, Mike, who's this guy? And she didn't know about all of his, minimizing of rape on Twitter or saying that like cultural diversity equals white genocide or people don't know this about him.
Yeah. Brendan and I were just reading the Guerrilla Mindset, man.
Right. I mean, no people idea. Didn't know that the guy's a professional pickup artist or that he makes his money. He made all his money from alimony he got from his wife,
from his
first
much
wife.
More successful first wife. Yeah. And that was the part of him that I did admire.
That was the only part,
that
really,
was the only
frankly,
reason
that
I thought there was worth looking at his work. I thought that was the point of the guerrilla mindset, was you get to sit on your ass and take your first wife's money
absolutely.
To create a sexist website.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of things that people don't know about Mike Cernovich. And one of the things that Mike Cernovich has done for me is, in addition to obviously helping us fundraise quite a bit, it's one of those things where you're like a victim of your own success. Because before I was a paid contributor on MSNBC, you know, I was a little bit more fun. And I would get a little more aggressive with things. And so Mike Cernovich, and we'll talk more about this later, but at least part of what we have raised so far on the GoFundMe, it was set up pretty quick as a Cernovich defense fund. Obviously, the best way to support the show is to become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com because we want you to hear things. But one of the things that I'm going to do to repay Mike Cernovich as a thank you note is that we're going to take some of those funds. We're going to commission a documentary from Matthew Film Guy, and it's going to get a lot of attention. I promise you, Mike. As you said on Twitter, you're already a very famous, well-known public figure. And he is. He's a famous, well-known public figure, like you say. Me, not so much. You, yes. That, I think, is absolutely clear. And you've stated that multiple times. But the public doesn't know everything about you. And that's the thing. The public loves to know about people. And so what we're going to do is make sure that the next time you try and smear somebody else, the public already knows all this about you as the source. So then you're going to have to find one of your minions to do this work for you in the future. But that's going to be problematic because then maybe someday you won't be as well known. And that's important for a guy who I think feels bad about not being able to sort of pay his own way through places.
Feels bad on the inside.
I think
so. And can I just also add on a much more petty level, the floodgates are back, are thrown away. Sam has asked me many times in the nature of charity and his own position in MSNBC to not constantly do this impression. And now it's going to happen endlessly.
We were a superpower. We are now a hyperpower.
So and it goes for that scumbag too.
Yeah.
That Vichy Ren was part of this as well.
Let me just the era of the pajama boys. It's over.
Totally done.
But the other thing. That I want to say, and we'll talk much more about that in the coming hour and days and minutes and weeks. I'm fired from MSNBC. I have mixed feelings about it. Like I say, going on Chris Hayes' show was always a lot of fun for me. I had some very good opportunities. Well, I'll talk more about it in the rest of the show. But, Mike Cernovich, he had one of his people, either he as a sock puppet or he paid somebody with his alimony money to email our advertisers. Some said they were contemplating leaving. Others said no way we would leave. I don't know exactly how that breaks down. I do know that Brooke Lennon is with us today. I'm psyched about it because I would hate to be sleeping on sheets that I love by a company that has said goodbye to me. So I'm very happy about this. Brooke Lennon, if you haven't heard me talk about them before, you can get high quality sheets and bedding you and your loved ones deserve without the needless luxury retail prices. Buying great sheets is an easy way to upgrade your nightly routine. The right sheets can make or break a good night's sleep. Brooke Lennon cuts out unnecessary markups, retail licensing fees, manufacturing waste in order to offer high-end designs and exceptional savings across their collection. It's the fastest-growing bedding brand in the world because people love these products. They were named winner of the best online bedding category by Good Housekeeping. This is luxury bedding underpriced. You got to try these sheets today. They're supporting the show, folks. So if you ever contemplate getting some sheets, today would be the day. I love my Brooklinen sheets. If you try them, I know you're going to love them too. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for my listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen's so confident you're going to love their sheets, you get a risk-free 60-day trial. Well, I guess night. Technically night. Well, maybe day. Day and night, frankly. You get a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. There's no reason not to give these sheets a try for yourself or as a gift this holiday season. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping, use the promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen.com. BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these are the best sheets ever. Do we have time? Yeah, we do, right? I want to play this. We mentioned, now look, one of the reasons why Mike Cernovich was attacking us, in fact, probably the primary reason, and I have reason to believe this.
There's a variety of possible reasons.
But I think this is the reason why he really did. I mean, it's obviously not a coincidence, right? He could have found many other tweets of mine that he wanted to promote. But one of the things, and now I know Mike Cernovich has said, I don't agree with Roy Moore. Of course, he went on to question the validity of some of the witnesses against Roy Moore, or I should say the victims. Well, one of those victims is speaking out, and I know this is going to bother Cernovich, but I'm still going to do this now. Just as Mike Cernovich had a problem with me calling out people who were justifying Roman Polanski's rape, I also call out Mike Cernovich for trying to run interference for Roy Moore, who is a child sex predator at best. And the Republican Party has stepped up to fund this guy again, because apparently the moral outrage they had 3 weeks ago has dissipated. Here is one of Roy Moore's victims. And remember, the big thing that Roy Moore trotted out was this signature on the yearbook. It's not mine. We've got a forensic handwriting specialist.
How depressing because, is it to be at that point?
Because you know in high school, what people do is they go and fake the DA's signature in their high school yearbook as a way of marking what a great high school career I had.
Well, it's how to be cool.
Right.
You're in with the assistant DA.
Tricky well, women.
Apparently some people came up with some other Roy Moore signatures and it looks identical. But here is a report from the Washington Post from one of Roy Moore's victims.
I was in the attic taking bins of Christmas decorations down, and I noticed one remaining bin in the attic. And when I glanced inside, that's when I saw the memories book. And I opened it up to the first page, and it says I was 17 years old. So I realized, well, this is my high school senior year memory book. And as I turned the pages, I came across a card, and it was a high school graduation greeting card from Roy Moore. Happy graduation, Debbie. I wanted to give you this card myself. I know that you'll be a success in anything you do, Roy. I've known Roy Moore for many years, and I met him in 1981, and we dated for a brief time, and we kissed with my consent, and I'm very sad that he's decided to say he doesn't know me.
Let me state once again, I do not know any of these women, did not date any of these women, have not engaged in any sexual misconduct with anyone.
I felt like this was the first thing that I've seen that I know personally for a fact to be a lie from his mouth. And he's spewing the lie from the pulpit of a church.
It's simply dirty politics.
Imagine that, spewing a lie from a pulpit in a church. I wonder if that's the first time that's ever happened. All right, folks, I'm glad you're all here today because we're all going to learn a little bit about social reproduction theory. This program, we interview a lot of different authors, about a lot of different topics. We try and introduce new ideas that you may not have been exposed to in terms of politics and policy. From, I would say, exclusively the left, although we do on occasion have libertarians on, which ends up being more comedic in nature. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Tithi Bhattacharya. We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Tithi Bhattacharya. She is a professor of South Asian history at Purdue University. She is the editor and contributor to Social Reproduction Theory, Remapping Class, Recentering Oppression. Welcome to the program, Tithi.
Thanks, Sam. Thank you for having me.
All right, so let's start with a rather, I'm going to approach this fairly rudimentary, as my understanding of social reproduction theory is fairly rudimentary. Tell us what is social reproduction theory?
Right. Well, it's a mouthful, isn't it? Social reproduction theory. So if the book had another title, it would probably be Who is Cooking Dinner? So the core concept of social reproduction theory and the central idea of the book can, despite its mouthful title, can be broken down in perhaps three simple steps. First, that all the goods and services in our society or in all capitalist societies are produced by working people. Workers make the toothbrush I use in the morning, they harvest the coffee beans I use for my coffee at lunch break, and they teach my child, nurture her mind at my local public school from where I pick her up in the afternoon. Second, all this work that creates and sustains society needs to happen on a daily and continuous basis, or it cannot be done by fits and starts. I mean, we cannot have cars being produced one day and then stopping, or nurses offering healthcare one day and then not. So the work and the various social networks that allow that work to happen must be both systematic and must be constantly regenerated and reproduced on a daily basis. So finally, and this is the punchline for social reproduction theory, if the work happens daily, then the worker who performs the work must also be regenerated and reproduced daily so that she or he can perform that work, right? Imagine what would happen if all workers worked 20-plus hour shifts every day. They would die and society would cease to function. So the time of non-work, or the quote-unquote free time, when people do not go to work, then is quite important. So that is when the worker eats, sleeps, in my case, posts cat pictures on Facebook and so on. In other words, that is the time off and for life, away from the time for work. If that time did not exist, there would be no work. But this time for life is also work, intense work. It is the work of cooking dinner, making the bed, cleaning the floor, doing the laundry, or the work that actually makes it possible to go back to the paid job next day, except it is not paid. So if mainstream economic theory tells us about work and production, social reproduction theory tells us about life and the reproduction of life, the time before and after work, or, as I said, who cooks the dinner. In short, if workers produce goods and services in society, who then produces the worker? Now, two further reflections perhaps follow from the concept. One, as you can imagine from the who cooks the dinner question, the vast amount of this work of producing life globally is still done by women. So the question of the work of life is heavily gendered. More men do housework now for sure than from, say, 50 years ago, and that is wonderful. But women still do more housework as compared to men. In this country, for example, according to the census figures, on an average day, 83% of women and I want to say 65% of men spend some time doing housework. But besides the gender question, the second implication of social reproduction theory is that it is not about the domestic sphere alone. Issues of production of life and the production of the worker also draws attention to other activities that help, quote-unquote, produce the worker and make her ready for her paid job. The school system teaches the future worker or the child the required skills for the job. The hospital system makes sure that she or he remains healthy to continue to go to work. A good public transport system ensures that she gets to work. Recreational facilities in the community make sure she has some leisure time away from the daily grind of work. And a good pension system ensures that the now past worker gets to have a decent life after a lifetime of work. So the social reproduction of life is about all these systemic social things that make the formal economy possible, and yet is often seen as the unimportant component part of the economy and of production. So social reproduction theory and my fellow contributors in the book sort of saw this book as a project to make that invisible sphere visible.
And is the an element of the theory that this aspect of life is equally as important or plays a unique role in the maintenance of people showing up at work through generations? I mean, what is the beyond the observation that this sphere is crucially important to providing this work product or this worker? What else does that? What is it important to know about that?
That's a great question. So the way we have envisioned this is, it appears under our modern system of the economy, which is capitalism, it appears as if the two spheres are very, very different, right? So the domestic sphere where the production of life takes place and the public sphere where the work takes place, production takes place, are very, very separate. And one of the one of the contributions of social reproduction theory is to actually show the connecting tissue between the two spheres, to say, yes, they may appear to be separate, but they are actually co-constituted. So changes in one sphere will absolutely affect the other and vice versa. So let's say, for instance, there is an attack on social services, and I hope we get to talk about that later, because I think that's very crucial for us with this new tax bill that's coming on. The attack on social services actually makes the worker at the point of production far more vulnerable than if she was part of a very robust, you know, public transport system, public service system, or welfare system, and so on. So in other words, if there is a housing crisis, if there is, if the water has high amounts of lead in it, if the public transport system is broken down, then the worker will be far more vulnerable at work and far more open to, you know, sort of the boss's attacks on work in all forms, you know, wage cuts, sexual harassment, etc. And I think there's vice versa, in the sense that the reduction and lowering of wages in the workplace, the breaking up of unions in the workplace, makes the worker also vulnerable in the social reproduction sphere, because there is really no money to afford high housing costs. So the two spheres are very, very co-constitutive and related. And I think that's one of the things that the book tries to draw attention to.
And I would say that to give a similar example in the positive, for instance, in New York City, we have universal pre-K. And the fact that my child can go to free pre-kindergarten frees me up to do this podcast, theoretically, right? I mean, that it cuts both ways.
Exactly. And this is why, if we come to the question of what are women's issues or what are feminist issues, I think social reproduction theory in general, and the book in particular, tries to say, well, there can't be separate feminist issues, right? So it has to be seen in the context of the totality of society, because a systemic attack on workplaces, or the reverse, as you say, actual institutions that provide public care in the public sphere are actually not gender-neutral acts, but actually have either a debilitating effect on gender relations or a wonderful effect on gender relations.
All right, let's break down, because so much of this is founded on people understanding that relationship. And how does that relationship between our so-called non-working life and our so-called working life, I mean, how does that that relationship grow? I mean, like, what, historically speaking, and I mean, it's in terms of its development, how did that relationship come about? I mean, what was, if there's such a symbiotic relationship between the two, you know, what came first? Or are we watching sort of like an egg, you know, a zygote split, or what is going on there?
Okay. I'm going to sort of reframe your question a little bit to talk about some concrete things which can kind of, for me, clarified or got me interested in the first place about that connection, right? So since, let's say, in the last, you know, decade or so, if we look at the global north and struggles in the global north, right? There are less and less struggles compared to, let's say, the 1930s or 1960s or even the 70s. In the global north, there are less and less workplace struggles. We do not see, you know, a fantastic rise in strike statistics. We do not see, we actually witness a terrible fall in union density across the board in the global north, and actually parts of the global south as well. So workplace struggles, in other words, have, declined in the global north in the last decades or so. And I would say that is part of the effect of neoliberal policies and neoliberal attacks. So that's a given. So that's the sphere of work. Now then, some people may conclude from that working class struggles are now over. You know, it's done, the labor movement is dead, and so on. We can now move on, and they have won. The other side has won. But if you look at across, the global north, and if you look across, say, for instance, in Latin America, you will see that struggle, far from having declined, has actually erupted in the non-workplace zone. You have struggles for water and water charges all over. You have struggles for housing, lower rent. You have struggles against racism and police brutality in this country, Black Lives Matter. You have struggles against anti-imperialism and so on. So these are, in one sense, non-workplace struggles. So what then is the connection? So one of the things that we talk about in the book is that neoliberalism and austerity measures first came for the workplace, right? So unions were broken, Reagan's air traffic control strikes, and Margaret Thatcher's miners' strikes. So unions were broken throughout the period of the 80s, so the attack was on the workplace. But there was also attack on social services on the workplace, right? So there was privatization of social services and so on, attacks on reproductive rights. But the fight back that has been happening, in a way, has to happen to begin with right now in the non-workplace sphere, because the power of collective organizing, because lack of union density, is so low in the workplace. So often the struggle happens, erupts out of the workplace over school closing or housing crisis, etc. But if there is a robust union movement or a social justice union approach, then those two fights do not have to stay separate. So in other words, if a working class community gains the cohesiveness and the fight through the fight for water, then it is unlikely that they will be, it's not unlikely, but it is also possible that they will have much more confidence to fight back in the workplace. I mean, I just want to point out that one of the things that was very hopeful for me in sort of making this point was what happened during the international women's strike that I was part of, was privileged to be a part of the organizing for on March 8th this year. So, there were demonstrations and marches and workshops, etc., in 25 cities in the United States. But there was a question that was asked of us, why is this a strike? Well, I mean, our clear answer was because it is, work is not just about the workplace. So right. Women walked out of their homes and domestic labor, etc. But because there was such momentum around March 8th, around the strike, actually what began outside of the workplace moved into the workplace. So three school districts actually went on strike. Alexandria City Public Schools in Virginia, Prince George's County Public Schools in Maryland, and the Chapel Hill Carborough School District in North Carolina. And as you can tell, the two, Virginia and North Carolina, are right-to-work states. So this was an amazing testimony, I guess, to us to understand the sort of connected realms of work and non-work and struggles to improve wages in the workplace and the struggles to improve life outside of the workplace.
And I think, we saw a good example of that with the Chicago Teachers Union strike in 2011, I think it was. And they are, Karen Lewis, who was the head of the union at that time, promoting a social union movement. And obviously, I mean, it's funny that you also cite schools, because that seems to be teachers seem to be the nexus of this type of and sort of the, I guess, the low-hanging fruit, if you will, of this nexus between home and work, because they have a relationship with their work. When people send their kids to school, they don't perceive them. They're sending them to work, per se. It's sort of a a third type of category, and that they interact with teachers there. I guess the relationship between parents and teachers gives you a beginning of that. But I guess I guess what I'm asking from a theoretical sense is how did this relationship, and maybe I'm looking at it wrong, through an incorrect theoretical frame, but did this relationship become, was it created, was it simply created because people were taken outside of their social lives and went to work? Was there what were the factors that, I guess, disenfranchised, if we're having to point out there's a particular relationship between what we generally, conventionally wisdom, think of work versus what we generally think of our life outside of work, where did that gulf come from? What is contributing to that gulf? Or was it there before and we need to see the connectivity? I mean, speak to that relationship.
All right. Okay, so this is something we understand in the book itself, but I understand as a theoretical framework myself, is something specific to capitalism. So in a pre-capitalist society or a feudal society, work and home are connected because most of the work happens within the home. And you don't have to go away from home, sometimes even away from your place of birth to work, and there is such a strict division between work and home. So this division begins with the modern capitalist system, where industrial production takes place outside of the home, and the home is kind of drained, if you like, of all productive activity. That does not mean that I'm saying that the work that's done in the home is, not important, quite the reverse. But industrial production or things that count in the formal economy happens outside of the home. So that's where the division starts. And actually, if you think about early industrial capitalism, for instance, the kind of accounts we have of northern English cities like Manchester or Lancashire, and these sort of vast factories belching smoke and all the workers who are going to work in it, it is men, women, and children. They are all working together in the factories, and they're working incredibly long hours. So there are these heartbreaking testimonies from mothers talking about their children at work and saying, I don't mind that she gets spanked or beaten by the boss as long as she's not fired or her wages are cut. So in other words, the wages are so little that in order to produce life or in order to survive, the entire family has to be at work. But if the entire family is at work, which is the early phase of capitalism, then the work of life really can't take place, because then there's no one actually to cook the dinner, to clean the dishes, and so on. So there is an incredible rise of mortality, and the conditions of the workers in the early part of capitalism is absolutely miserable. They live in squalor and, near-death conditions. So, and that's bad in the long run for the bosses, because if there are no workers, then where is the profit and the work going to come from? So what happens in the early stage of capitalism is actually the capitalist state then intervenes and says, wait, we need to have working hours reduced, and here is the gender part of it, let's save a part of the working force for the homework while a part of the working force goes to work. And that's where the sort of homemaker, breadwinner kind of division comes from, which actually, because capitalism is such a greedy system, it didn't have in the beginning. So it was kind of a sort of live and learn process for capitalism as well, which created this sort of strict, very strict division between work and home, and was maintained through sort of gendered ideologies that then came into effect, that women cannot do heavy work, women are more prone to, you know, doing embroidery or whatever as compared to working in the mines. So that's something very clearly that happens from the start of capitalism. And, you know, there is a very clear framework to understand this in Marx, but there are also silences in Karl Marx's work about this process. So, for instance, one of the things that Marx points out is the worker has to go to work because of the processes of dispossession that happened a generation ago. So, in other words, the means to reproduce life, access to land, access to food, was taken away from the worker through, for instance, in England, through the enclosure processes and so on, then the worker has to go to work and work for a wage in order to be able to produce life. Whereas previously, in the agricultural feudal system, the worker had access to those means of producing life. That's why life and work could happen in the same sphere. So if those means are taken away, then the worker goes to work. But Marx says that the worker is dispossessed and all he or she has to sell to the capitalist is her labor power. Now, labor power, Marx says, is not labor. It's the ability to work. And he says, I don't remember the exact words, but he says that just like any other machine, that labor power needs to be replaced, regenerated, etc. But that's where he stops. You know, he doesn't probe the question of what then are the means and ways in which that capacity to work is regenerated. So that kind of silence is where I think social reproduction theory comes in and takes up that question.
I see. And so we have the development at that point of, I guess, some pre-existing gender disparities, right? I mean, we can go back to biblical times and see that women do not have the same rights or sovereignty that men do, but that dynamic is what leads to the development of women will head back home. They will be in charge of making sure that the man can come in to work the next day. He's rested. He's fed. He just enough so that he can produce the widgets that I can then turn around as the owner of the store, of the factory, the capitalist, and sell those widgets at a profit, and then the whole process starts over again.
Right. So just the one point I think I would make is you're absolutely right that women's oppression and the notions of inferiority of women as compared to men absolutely predates capitalism, right? There is no question of that. However, I think what we would argue is that the oppression, the fact of oppression perhaps continues, but the way oppression works under capitalism is very different from the way oppression worked under feudalism or, you know, pre-feudal societies. So in other words, capitalism is a bit of a MacGyver, okay? So it takes what pre-existed it, and then it works that thing into working for itself and working for its system. Because the kind of ways in which women's oppression worked in the past will not work in the present. Because think about the fundamental claim, which is obviously not substantiated in reality, but the fundamental claim capitalism has to make is that all people are equal under the law. So the question of inferiority and even those kind of things and the way oppression works will have to be reworked for capitalism. That does not mean there is no oppression. In fact, the whole point is that it is pretty acute, but it's a different way that oppression works under capitalism than it did before.
So that oppression is not formalized in law and then carried out. It is more social constructs that are maintained or developed that in some way take advantage of the pre-existing of I guess the vestiges of the more formalized oppression. Does that make sense?
But right. But I mean, the taking advantage of the vestiges is absolutely right. But sometimes the oppression is also formalized in law. For instance, you know, the question of suffrage, right? So early capitalist societies didn't think it was necessary to give women suffrage, but they couldn't actually, but when the right for suffrage came up, women argued that, well, in all your documents, you say that all people are equal, so why should we not have the vote? So the existence of that document, as it were, the existence of the horizon makes it possible for, made it possible for women of that generation to argue. But I think oppression, women's subalternity or submission under capitalism is maintained through the existence of the family. So women's, the way capitalism is structured, and this is something also social reproduction theory talks about, is that it's not just the actual maintenance and regeneration of the workforce, but is actually also the reproduction of the workforce, right? Giving birth to a new generation of workers within the privatized sphere of the family, and all that stuff that happens within the privatized sphere of the family that the state or the bosses do not feel they have to pay for. So in other words, they basically get a fully formed worker who comes to their workplace and works for them, and the little money that capitalism has spent on the sort of social services that go towards that production of the worker, capitalism and austerity is eager to cut back upon. So all of the responsibility of social reproduction from birth to maintenance to everything then is sort of projected by neoliberalism as the individual responsibility of families. So that's where the kind of argument for family values and a reinforcement of gender roles sort of come from.
I mean, I guess in my typical analysis, I would look at this as sort of an externality that you have someone looking to make a profit and they offload their costs of making that profit to society. But this is even more, I think, specific in this instance. And so, all right. So broadly, I mean, so, and this dynamic, I mean, this is what we're talking about here is the relationship between Marxism and what we, I think, mistakenly sometimes call identity politics, where we see this relationship where these gender roles are reinforced, or certain gender oppression, I should say, are reinforced and in some ways, I guess, constructed specifically to the benefit of people making money. And therefore, that's why there's sort of tends to be a, I guess, a parallel tracks from capitalists and I guess a family values, like you're saying. So, all right. So how do we apply this analysis?
Okay. So this is what the book is all about. And if you get a chance to read some of the wonderful contributions, it is about how to ultimately, I mean, there's a lot of theory in it, but it is ultimately about how do you apply this theory in our current context. So I'm just going to reel back a little bit and go back to talking about, let's look at sort of the tax bill that that has recently passed, right? So what are the things that are that they are claiming that with the tax bill will come severe cuts to Medicaid, right? Now, what is Medicaid? It's not a gender-neutral, race-neutral system. It provides healthcare coverage to over 33 million women and girls. And so women comprise more than half of the adult Medicaid recipients. Eliminating the student loan interest deduction would reduce the economic security of recent graduates, but especially Black women who have the highest mean cumulative debt after college, right? So in other words, if you have a separate fight for feminism or gender, we cannot afford that anymore. We cannot afford to deal with issues that affect women only as women's issues. We need a systemic fight back in general, because, you know, if we look at the housing crisis, right, the 2008 crash affected disproportionately women of color and communities of color. If we look at the water crisis in places like Detroit and Flint, we know that, you know, about 40% of the residents in Detroit were behind on their water bills, and a number of low-income and African-American households there have lived for years without running water in their homes. And low-income communities and communities of color disproportionately experience contaminated tap water, right? So it is one of the surveys I read shows that Black children are three times more likely than white children to have elevated levels of lead in their blood. I mean, this is a disgraceful statistic I'm quoting here for one of the richest countries of this of this planet, right? So how do we then think about these sort of fights for life-making activities and their connection to the fights for the union fights and fight for wages, et cetera? So one of the things we have to remember that people go to work not for wages, but people go to work so that their wages can help them have a stable life. So it is for life and a better life that people work. So we cannot forget that sort of inherent connection. And that's why, you know, places like Britain and even in America, we have questions about the living wage, which I think is a very interesting conjunction of the life and wage kind of relationship. But a movement that I think can be can encompass that is exactly the kind of movement that you mentioned, which is the Chicago Teachers Union struggle. You know, when school closures happened in communities, the Teachers Union, the CTU, took its banner there to protest. But when people were evicted from their homes in the south side of Chicago, when Latino neighborhoods were affected by high rents, the CTU also took its banner there to defend these people. And so when they went on strike, the communities saw that, oh, it's the same union that was there for my struggle. And the amount of support that the CTU strike got from the general working class communities and ordinary people of Chicago was precisely for this reason, and it was absolutely extraordinary. So I think any social movement in our times must champion with equal vigor working class struggles based in communities around water, housing, or police violence alongside of workplace struggles. It will have to learn to unify sort of universal demands like, you know, healthcare for all with race and gender specific ones, for instance, about affirmative action or reproductive justice. Because, I mean, one of the things that I love about these words of Angela Davis is that it absolutely shows you the dangers of not standing in solidarity with all struggles against the system everywhere. Because she says, if they come for me in the morning, they will come for you in the night.
Right. And I think, I mean, the irony of the upcoming massive attack we're going to see on public sector unions, which remains the largest density of unionism in this country, very well may be that unions are forced to find their allies outside of where we traditionally, you know, perceive the essence of unionism to live at work. Now, of course, I mean, there was a time where there was much more union density, and that unionism would carry to your local pub or to the union hall or outside of that. But Jamie would like to ask a question. She's here, and she actually recommended you as a guest. So special question from Jamie today.
Hi, Teezy.
Of course. Hi, Jamie.
So I guess a lot of what we talk about on the show is sort of how we get back those like New Deal style modes that help us with our social reproduction, like healthcare, housing, blah, blah, blah. And in our current moment of crisis, which I think most of us can agree is happening right now, a lot of the old modes and institutions of social reproduction that we saw arise in the Fordist era are breaking down. Birth rates are dropping. Millennials are not getting married. More young people are living with their parents or roommates and with a spouse for the first time since modernity. And it's increasingly rare that one person's income can support a whole family. So given that a lot of these dying processes operated in service of capital and were sort of a stabilizing force in bourgeois society, do you see in this moment of breakdown, like even though it's obviously very bad on a practical level for lots and lots of people, do you also see some sort of radical potential to not just bring back what we had before with this sole breadwinner patriarchal system, but replace it with something maybe better and more egalitarian?
Well, you know, as a socialist and as a feminist, my calling card is hope, right? You always have hope on the conditions changing, and you always have hope in the ability of ordinary people to change their living conditions. And, you know, I feel that I have to point out that even in this country, since Trump got elected, we have seen some extraordinary developments that can energize that sort of little sapling of hope that we all nurture in ourselves. You know, I would point to the Women's March, the Women's Strike. I would point to the extraordinary airport protests that just ordinary people spontaneously went to the airports to protest Trump's law. And, you know, especially with the new Supreme Court justice, I hope we see another round of that. So in other words, you know, I think this is unsustainable. This situation, this condition of the grabbing of all wealth by a tiny handful of people is unsustainable for society, or unsustainable for the globe, and unsustainable also in a much more scary way, which is for the future of the planet. So I do think we will see struggles in the coming years, struggles erupt. The real question is, as you say, what is going to be the model of struggle? Like, we cannot have a union movement starting up, which, like Richard Trumka says, you know, the wall, if it's being built, should be a union wall, or the, you know, pipeline that should be built should be a union pipeline. I mean, we cannot have that approach to social justice and social struggle. And this is why I think social reproduction theory and our lessons from anti-racist and feminist struggles is our struggles are united, that it is unsustainable, that if you do not back Black Lives Matter, then you cannot be a true champion for even a wage struggle at work, because a wage struggle at work must be, by its very nature, anti-racist and pro-women. So those are not separate fights. And can we imagine a sort of revitalized social movement? Yes, I think we can. I mean, let's think about the first sort of rumblings of the union movement in this country on a social scale. Those were started by young women and immigrant women, right? So, I mean, after the shirtwaist factory fire, that's what started. So, I mean, I think we are back at that point of the early 20th century where the denudation of our struggles will mean that struggles will erupt from unlikely quarters, not from Richard Trumka, but from the queer black immigrant woman on the streets who has an absolute interest in fighting the system as a whole. You know, there's a wonderful poem by a Jewish feminist from the 1930s, Tilly Olson, called "I Want You Women Up North to Know." And she says, you know, how your children's dresses are stained with blood of the women workers down south. But the poem ends and it gives a list of all the ways that the women workers in the north produce these dainty dresses for Macy's and all the supermarkets. But it ends on a note that I think we should pay attention to. It says, "Women up north, I want you to know, I tell you, this can't last forever. I swear it won't."
Tithi Bhattacharya, the book is Social Reproduction Theory, Remapping Class, Recentering Oppression. Thank you so much for coming on today. We'll put a link to that book at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Sam, and thanks, Jamie.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Maybe we'll do a freebie Tuesday today. But we will take a quick break.
What?
You have a new song?
Steven sent in it's a song called Situation Sam.
Steven, just Steven, a listener, Steven.
Listener Steven, I don't know if I want to say his last name or not.
Okay, fair enough. Listener Steven, this is going to be the break song, is that what you're talking about? Okay, that'll be a good idea. Just a reminder, you can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com, becoming a member. We do have, people have asked us about that GoFundMe site. We threw that up moments after, I don't know when it was, maybe an hour, sometime last night. And we're going to dedicate at least part of that to doing this documentary to further Mike Cernovich's fame. I mean, he's super famous when you read him. I mean, that's why I can't pronounce his name.
We're going to research him so well that we'll get the pronunciation right.
Maybe. I mean, but my point is that he, like he says, he is a public figure. And he stated this many times, a big public figure. I'm not.
No,
I mean, I do this little...
Because you don't have a gorilla mindset.
Well, there's probably a myriad of reasons. There couldn't have been a less well-known contributor on MSNBC than me. I mean, no. I was. I don't even know if they had any other pay-per-appearance types.
No, I doubt it.
I'm not even sure they would have known I was there, frankly, if it wasn't for Mike Cernovich, because like he says, he is a public figure. And he's very well-known. And... So we're going to dedicate part of that. And then part of it is also going to be just to make up for what we've lost on advertising. And the more we get members, the more we can deal with folks like Mike Cernovich without having to worry about them trying to cut off our funding. You know, we can't go back in time and say to his former wife, "Hey, you don't want to marry this guy because look at what he's going to tweet in the future." That's what's in his head.
"We have a message from the future to Mike Cernovich's much more successful ex-wife. He's going to take your hard-earned legal earnings and turn it into a disgusting website and Twitter career, which apologizes for rape, racism, and every type of despicable thing imaginable. Stop before you married a troubled man that you feel obvious immense compassion for. This will be the biggest pity sex you will ever regret in your life. This Stop it now.
Like
I'm
a Terminator.
To you in Cernovichese so you understand.
This is like the theme. This is what the story
of
Terminator 2 was.
Terminator 2, except this time it's my Cernovich.
But we want you to become a member and listen to the program. I think you're going to enjoy it. Some Daves, we have long interviews about what is social reproduction theory. Other days, we'll be talking about Roy Moore, or we'll be talking about, a whole mix of things. Also, on our YouTube page or via iTunes, you can find TMBS, which is the Michael Brooks Show, which I cannot promise you will not be 90 minutes of Mike Cervanich speaking.
It's actually usually a much more kind of high-minded sort of show with a fair amount of comedy, but a lot of international coverage and stuff. But tonight, yes.
Tonight, your guests will be?
Matt Brunig. We're talking about creating a think tank for the masses and social democratic policy.
I don't think so.
Oh, that's right. That wasn't on purpose.
You don't think that Matt Brunig is
no,
be
I was actually grabbing
Brooks
this that was going to remind me that it's Matt's birthday today, our own Matt.
Oh.
And my neighbor Randy's birthday. So happy birthday, guys.
Well, happy birthday, Matt.
So Matt Brunig, who else?
Big Waz, Wazni Lombre, regular crew. He's from Leverage the Chat. We're going to talk about that. And then for we're going to talk about Spike Lee and She's Got to Have It. And then for and then on the post game for patrons, Milton Alamati's in studio. But for most relevant, I guess, for longtime Majority Report people, Matt Binder and I are reuniting.
It's going to be like an 8-hour show.
It's going to be about an hour and a half public show and then an hour post game. Matt Binder and I are reuniting on an Eminem special pyramid segment, and we're going to lock a certain very whack media entity into the pyramid.
I would say most people who aren't familiar with the show understood about three out of those 25 words in that sentence.
Which the was?
Just coffee. Pyramid.
Oh, no. WAC is your...
JustCoffee.coop. Advertisers who have been with this show from the get-go. If you go, just coincidentally, MR Holiday gets you 30% off their coffee with free shipping. MR Holiday is the coupon code. JustCoffee.coop. We're going to take a quick break, but non-members, you will stay with us as we will talk a couple of these stories, and I will say a little bit more about the MSNBC thing, but we'll be right back.
Ayo, this is called Situation Sam.
Sam's like, no, 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 no. Thought experiments too. Sam says, no, 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 no. Buddy listens to Caller 3.
I mean, that was, it was good. We are back. This would normally be the fun half. Ladies and gentlemen,
isn't this still fun?
It's still
fun. We're going to make it not
Where
fun.
Where is my sound sheet? I somehow lost my. I got it. Forget it.
Another theme, by the way, if you're new to the show, is Sam's missing and quickly recovered sound sheet.
That's the way we do it here. We miss it and then we find it. Oh boy, I'm really.
Skype interface? You about to complain about that?
Nope. Okay. I was actually thinking about how much fun I'm going to have with that Cernobogich documentary. Let's get some of that over with, shall we, folks? Mike Cernobogich was very, very happy. Look at, he's got sweet new glasses. He's out celebrating.
Celebration shades.
He, now, understand this, okay? I want to tell you a little bit of background on this. So Mike Cernobogich tweets out, finds this tweet of mine from 2009 where I'm knocking people who are supporting. I guess what happened was that Polanski got arrested, I think. And but all I remember is that there were members of the Hollywood community, filmmakers such, who were signing a petition to get to rehabilitate Roman Polanski in some fashion. And I found it disgusting, and I responded with satire, suggesting that if I didn't care about Polanski, but if my daughter was raped, that I would hope it would be by a an older man who had a great sense of mise-en-scene. Now, one of the tip-offs that people could have known that it was a satire might have been the use of mise-en-scene when you talk about that, or just the fact that, you know, if he's paying somebody to look through my tweets, one would anticipate that somewhere between 2009 and 2017, you'd find something else that was problematic in that way. But I mean, I think Mike knows that he was purposely misinterpreting it, but that's fine. He could say, hey, you've purposely misinterpreted the fact that I was charged with rape and pled it down to a misdemeanor battery. He could say that. That's fine. It's a free country. So here's the thing. As much as play as Cernobogich got the first day or two, Seb Gorka retweeted it. Donald Trump Jr. retweeted it.
Yeah.
Nobody else picked it up. In fact, what is the name of that thing? It's like, there's a bot checker. And a buddy of mine who is in this type of like business, not our business, but more like the tech business, he ran a bunch of those tweets through botcheck.me, where you can find out through their analysis, are these real Twitterers? Or are these real bots? Are these bots? And not all of them were bots, but the vast majority were bots. So this is obviously an operation that is funded. You buy those bots, you set it out, and this is the way that Mike Cernobogich makes his hay. And then he's got to jump on Periscope, I guess, to announce his victory. Here it is, Mike Cernobogich excited that he won.
And we're back. Mike Cernobogich.com. Big breaking news.
Pause it. Does he have trouble pronouncing his name too? Could you roll that back? Because it sounds like he has trouble pronouncing his name.
He should extend us a lot more courtesy if that's the case.
If that's the case.
And we're back. Mike Cernobogich.com. Big breaking news.
Sounds
Sam Cedar, who is MSNBC contributor, he is no longer an MSNBC News contributor. After a tweet of him making a joke about child rape and Roman Polanski was reported by Mike Cernobogich and was made publicly available. Thank you to everybody who emailed MSNBC. Thank you to all
Pause
of you,
it.
Your heroes.
Now, no one emailed MSNBC.
Or is that himself?
I know from our advertisers, they got one or two emails, and it was clearly either him or his assistant. So there wasn't that many emails at all from MSNBC. But he's got to pretend like this is a grassroots organization he's got going here, when in fact it's more like that dude from the Catholic League who was just in an office with a secretary and would go on news back in the day and say that he was representing all Catholics. Now, maybe Mike Cernobogich is saying, I represent everybody who's ever been charged with rape and pled down to a misdemeanor.
I'm the plea down to the misdemeanor from Rape League, and we are incredibly upset about Roman Polanski satire.
Here we go.
Thank you to all of you, your heroes. You're heroes because you emailed MSNBC and you let them know about the tweet. You let them know the people will not, people will be heard. We are the media now. We are the media now. And if you endorse, or you can call it satire, Sam goes satire, whatever, MSNBC ain't laughing.
He is right about the satire chops of MSNBC, apparently.
I wonder if he went on to say that I endorsed what? Huh. That seems to be a willful mischaracterization, particularly since he knows that I call it satire. That's odd. I'm not a public figure, folks. I'm just a little guy. I'm not like as powerful and as well-known as Mike Cervantes knows that he is.
Essentially running a little cottage industry out of Brooklyn at best.
Wow.
Hmm.
So that was Cervantes pretending that there was a group of people who were doing this. There is Mike Cervantes. He seems to have strategically placed himself under an aardvark on a painting to make it look like the aardvark is actually like pooping him out. I wonder if he did that on purpose. He's got a wonderful sense of mise-en-scene. Let's hear what he says.
Just for those of you watching, I will tell you one thing. That there is a campaign of terror being waged against my family. And if you're part of that, or if you give aid and comfort to those who are attacking my family, I will do everything legally allowed. I don't need to break any laws. Sam Cedar, I didn't break any laws. I just paid somebody to go through his tweets. I'm paying people to go through all your tweets if you've ever given aid and comfort to somebody who's trying to lead a campaign of terror against my family. So let that be a message to you. Troll me all you want. Call me a Nazi, a rapist. I don't care what you say about me.
Pause it. So Mike Cervantes says it's okay to call him a rape apologist and a Nazi or whatever we want.
Noted.
This well-known public figure has just stated he's perfectly fine with that characterization. Okay.
We shall proceed.
We shall bow down to you and you shall be our leader.
But if you go after my family, or you give aid and comfort to those who are going after my family.
Pause it.
Then it's...
What does aid and comfort mean? Are there bands of roving guerrillas who are trying to attack his family and people are actually like putting them up? Or what are they doing?
I don't know.
Aid and comfort.
Got this from the same sort of like Pizzagate sort of source.
I don't know that we've ever even acknowledged that he could have a family on this.
I'm shocked.
I am pretty shocked.
I'm just very
it.
Familiar with his much more successful ex-wife, whose alimony he got. That's
does he
what
mean
I'm
maybe
aware
that's what he
of.
Means. I thought he meant the Pizzagate investigation family.
Oh, is that what he's talking about? That's odd. Maybe he has a very extended family notion. I'm not sure. Is anything
Donald Trump
minute.
Is
Let's
my family. He's my father.
It's going to be very personal. I will do everything legally allowed. Nothing illegal. I don't need to break the law. So.
Just adding to my impression.
So now, what does this guy do? Is he selling his vitamins online? Is that right?
Let me double check. I believe he does.
Huh.
I thought I know about the gorilla mindset.
All right, well. Who knows? Well, so there's Mike Cervantes. He's a well-known figure, as you know. He has stated that multiple times, so we were just playing that video because he's news.
Entrepreneur, journalist,
mm-hmm.
stay-at-home layabout, receiver of alimony.
Oh, God. This is going to be fun.
Incidentally, we forgot to mention yesterday that it was the one-year anniversary of the Pizzagate shooting.
Oh, well, congratulations. That is great. Everybody remembers Pizzagate shooting where somebody was listening to Mike Cervantes, I guess one of the members of his... Oh, wow. 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 People pretty excited about that. I mean, he's a very well-known figure, as you know. And he inspired someone to go in and shoot up a pizza parlor looking for a pedophilia ring. Here is, oh, wait, what is this? This is, oh, this is Vic Berger. And folks, if you're not following Vic Berger on Twitter.
Do it.
Or on his YouTube channel, do yourself a favor. It is hilarious stuff. But it's also just based on real footage and captures the true essence of a human being in a way that I don't think I've ever seen. And if there's anything that you remotely find appealing about this program, you will appreciate Vic Berger.
You've seen Vic Berger on this program before.
Well, not seen him. I mean, you've
heard him.
You heard his disembodied voice. But here it is. Pizzagate. This is entitled Pizzagate. Mike Cernovich on 60 Minutes.
You know, yes or no, did you know that most people in media are pedophiles?
This past December, Edgar Welch opened fire in a Washington, D.C. pizzeria. He told police he was there to rescue children forced into prostitution by Hillary Clinton.
They literally have a fucking sex dungeon. Most people don't know this.
The story of Secretary Clinton's child sex trafficking operation in a pizzeria was invented before the election by fraudulent news sites and shared by millions. These news stories are fakes.
They're definitely not fake.
They're lies.
They're not lie at all. 100% true.
Do you believe that, or do you say that because it's important for marketing your website?
Oh, I believe it. I don't say anything that I don't believe.
That doesn't seem like a very high bar.
It's a high bar because I'm an attorney. I know how to weigh and measure evidence. What I'm doing is, it's punchy. It's fun.
One person said that they prayed that someone would come and kill everyone inside.
It's counterintuitive. It's counter-narrative.
They wanted to see my guts cut out and spill on the floor of my restaurant.
And it's information that you're not going to see everywhere else.
There is zero evidence saying that the gunmen at Comet Pizza today had anything to do with Pizzagate.
So the gunmen... The gunman just so happens to be an actor. What a coinkity. What a coinkity.
So this is fake news.
Cernovich's website is just one of hundreds publishing nonsense on the right and on the left.
Fake news is very, very dangerous.
In August, he published, Hillary Clinton has Parkinson's disease, physician confirms. You don't think that's misleading?
No.
You believe it's true today?
Oh, absolutely. She had a seizure and froze up.
Well, she had pneumonia. I mean,
how do you know?
The point is, you didn't talk to anybody who'd ever examined Hillary Clinton.
I don't take anything Hillary Clinton is going to say as true. And that's why we are in these different universes.
What stories have you published that turned out to not be right?
None that come to mind.
None.
Come to mind, no. 100% true.
Happy Thanksgiving. Take care of your kids. Keep an eye out. Keep an eye out on people.
Oh, God. What a genius.
Wow. It's counterintuitive.
It's counterconventional.
Counterconventional.
It's countertop.
I know a lot about law, like marrying a much more successful wife, getting her money.
I knew a lot about family law.
Family law.
Divorce law.
Family law. You pass the bar, I get your money. It's the law.
Speaking of the underlying issue here, Mike Cernovich, the important thing that he's got going on is try and distract, and he's done a pretty good job, from the fact that the Republican Party, the conservative movement, the alt-right, is desperate to make sure that Roy Moore is not held accountable for his being a child sex predator. And now, of course, Alabama is the last place you would imagine a Republican losing a federal election. But they're very concerned. I mean, the RNC has jumped back in with money. The RNC is officially backing Roy Moore. McConnell came out the other day and said, yeah, remember before when I said we would expel him from the Senate? No, not really anymore, because it seems to have died down. There's only 7 women. And because we're not seeing 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, like we saw with Trump.
Actually, in Syria, yeah, right. What number would actually make a difference to these people, if we're being real?
I think...
How many women do you need to be... girls do you need to assault before it matters to Republican leadership?
I don't think there is a number. I think it has to do with relative to how much time there is.
Ah.
So I think it's more of like a rate.
Right.
How often does it come out that he preyed on women? Now, remember...
McConnell needs to get on TV and be like, look, he's going to need to be banned from a lot more malls than just one.
Listen,
you want us to take it seriously. We got tax cuts to pass.
It's not like, I mean, how many, I don't know. I mean, Roy Moore, just because he preyed on young girls doesn't mean that he preyed on, you know, dozens and dozens. I mean, maybe you don't have the time.
The discerning
Maybe
pedophile.
He was a discerning, I mean, honestly, I mean. Yeah.
I'm a serial monogamous pedophile.
That's right.
Yep. No, my girlfriend has a trigonometry test, and I'm prepared for a case.
And here is how. Here is how his paid campaign spokesperson defends Roy Moore on the what's happening in terms of the continued evidence that's coming out that Roy Moore was preying on young women. She's on CNN with Poppy Harlow, and she is basically saying, look, we'll forgive child sex predation if we think we can get somebody in there who is anti-choice. We just had that freeze up.
Server attack. Server.
Wait, a DDoS.
It's a deep state.
Nothing
deep
illegal.
State
only legal things.
Because of Roman Polanski supporters.
Joining me now is Moore's campaign spokeswoman, Janet Porter. Janet, it is nice to have you on. Thank you for joining us. And let me get right to it.
So thank you. It's great to be with you. And by the way, congratulations on your unborn child. That's the reason why I came down as a volunteer to speak for Judge Roy Moore, because he'll stand for the rights of babies like yours in the womb, where his opponent will support killing them up until the moment of birth.
Janet, thank you for being with us, and I appreciate the congratulations on our son on the way. Now let's get right to this.
How about this? Excuse me, unpaid spokesperson who's not getting any money for Judge Moore. You want to extrapolate on that whole thing about Doug Jones having no problem with killing a child up until the moment of birth? What did you say? I mean, it's just absurd.
It was very surprising of Doug Jones as a conservative Southern Democrat to say that. I was surprised when he said we needed to find bipartisan solutions for the deficit, and also that there should be an exemption even after the child was born, up until a year, if the parents just want to get rid of it.
It was
side of the road. I thought it was very...
It's pretty bold.
Bold to run that way. It was even beyond the social reproduction interview. I thought it was kind of striking. Just to be clear to everybody, that was sarcasm.
I don't know about that. Think about it.
My God, he just lied about Doug Jones. Everything's flurrying. Do I defend Doug Jones from the lie, or do I spread the lie, or do I suffering succotash? Not everything that's clear is taking your much more successful ex-wife's money.
Well, that's the dynamic that's going on there. That is how the anti-choice folks and ostensible, I guess, evangelicals support a child sex predator. There it is. It would be nice if the media pushes back on this stuff, because it's not going to get any better, folks. And I don't know, I'll probably talk about this more at length, but the media feel that, and this is fundamentally why I decided to, when MSNBC let me go, why I decided to make a bigger issue of it than they had hoped it would be. And it is because there is this sense that the media has, frankly, even corporations have, that you can avoid controversy in this context. Now, maybe, and I think partly because of the polarization we have in this country, partly because of technology that exists now, social media, those days are over. And you may think you're avoiding controversy, but what you're ultimately doing is you're choosing a side. And corporations, I know, it's really more of, it's less imperative in my mind that they choose a side. If they want to attempt to be neutral and just get caught up in this and their brand is hurt, whatever, that's a corporate decision to make. But if you're a media outlet and you are part of our society that gets special rights in some respects, right? I mean, the media is far more protected in some instances because it's the media, because it has an important role to fulfill in society. Constitution makes reference of a free press. And there's a greater obligation for the way that you function in society. And not only can you not avoid controversy in this day and age, not only are you choosing a side, you have to, but if you do not have the ability to make a clear-eyed assessment of that tweet, which you could show, I mean, we had support of that tweet from the guy from InfoWars, from Red State, Eric Erickson, who blocks me, who has blocked me for years, said that tweet was obviously satire. Other people from Red State, InfoWars. If you as a media outlet, that is a mainstream media outlet, you're dealing with millions and millions of dollars of production. If you do not have the ability to stand behind a rational assessment of reality, then there is only fake news. If you cannot make an assessment that when you walk out your door at 12 noon in New York City, and you look up and you see that there's a sun there, and if you cannot make the assessment that the sun is there in the sky because it's 12 noon today, then you have lost your entire reason to exist as a media outlet.
But David Duke tells me that it's evening and that the Jews were involved. Look, I don't want to deal with this.
But
no more controversy.
I'm divorcing this from who's on what side, but simply saying that across the board, I cite these people not because they have different politics than I cite them because it's indicative of how any reasonable, rational adult could tell what the meaning of that tweet was. And you pretended at MSNBC because you had to make some type of excuse when you talked to the rap. But you also pretended when you didn't come. I mean, on day one, you should have just said, that tweet is fine. We don't need to address this. And your failure to do that, I mean, frankly, you know, look, I, at the end of the day, my folks aren't going to be able to say, you know, have people come up to them and say, we saw your son on TV. That's going to be the largest impact on my life. Aside from the fact that I won't have to shave as much and I won't, the quality of my shirts are going to diminish greatly.
Affect all of us.
Which are going to affect everybody.
Sort of bathing habits and
but
stuff.
The bottom line is we have a real problem in this country. If the media can't even do and make definitive the most basic of assessments, that is their job. That is not a value judgment. That is, we are English speakers. We understand how sentences are constructed. We understand meaning is derived from context. And all of those things were available to MSNBC. And the fact that they would not choose to exercise even the most basic sense of assessing a situation is the real problem. And the media has got to change, because if they don't, then there is no difference between fake news and not fake news. I forgot to call into the... Oh, did I call into the call?
Yeah, you did. We were kvetching about Skype earlier.
No, there we go. Okay. All right. Well, let me pull up some calls. That's not it.
Kvetching. Chew word.
The only thing I've seen from Mike Cernanovich in that respect is a, is him doing the whatever that.
That yeah, I suppose
he's done that a lot. Apparently, he gets a real kick out of that. Now maybe it's just satire. Maybe he thinks it's satire. I don't know.
Well, that's the game that all. I mean, I think actually, in fact, I have heard that they were doing that intentionally to embarrass people in media. I mean. That Sartre essay about these people not taking anything they do seriously and operating with unending cynicism is true. And that's why, again, the real danger is just what you pointed out. If people who hold some boundaries in broader discourse bow to that, then that's there's no
exactly,
hope.
That's exactly it. Calling from a 210 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Good afternoon, Sam. It's John from San Antonio.
John from San Antonio.
Yeah, I want to thank you for this show. You do your research, you know your history, you're a great interviewer, and my main question I ask for continued viewing on any media outlet is, am I learning from this outlet? And I'm constantly learning from this show. So people like Cernovich and David Duke, they want to protect the plutocracy, move away from democratic norms, and support white nationalism. They are simply on the wrong side of history. MSNBC made a big mistake. More people will be getting their news from indie outlets, and I don't know what the future of cable news is, but right now they're neglecting the left, and as we move into the third decade of the 21st century, the left will be ascendant. You see it in the polling. You see it in support for Bernie Sanders and our revolution, and that's the future of the country. So I tried to up my membership, but they're saying that since I'm already a member, they wouldn't accept it or whatever. So I'm not sure about what the solution
well, John,
to that
let me,
is.
Let me just add, I mean, one of the ways that people learn when listening to this show about things is a function of your calls. So let me just say, I appreciate it. And, I appreciate your contributions to this program. You make it a better show.
All right. Well, thank you. You've been very kind to me through the years, so I appreciate that. So, getting back to the,
what's happening in Alabama? That's the question.
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, it's one of the great, sadness of this country, you know, is just that people they're not able to distinguish the difference between reality. I mean, you talk about this a lot. So yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, it looks like Moore will probably win, but it'll be close, and that average will be coming back, you know, to the averages for the special elections, which have been about 17 points. Even though Sessions didn't run in 2014, Trump won by 27 points. And so, you know, the variation is, you know, if he makes it less within 3 points, I mean, that's going to be an incredible, you know, rise. And so, you know, these other races in the midterms, they're not going to be, within 27 point win for Republicans. There are going to be plenty that are 5 point wins, 10 point wins, 15 point wins, and those are the ones that they're going to lose in the midterms. So I also want to extend my condolences to Jamie and Sean for the loss of Sean's brother. As a country, we need to give people the help they need. Medicaid for All will help so many people. And we're doing the opposite of what we should be doing concerning taxation on the rich. I'll take this back to Chris Matthews when he was interviewing a Bernie supporter in Wisconsin in their primary. He kept going, how are we going to pay for this? And if I was on the panel, I would have been said, you know, I would have said, severely tax your ass. You know, somebody making your salary was taxed at 70% before Reagan, at 90% under Eisenhower, and you should be taxed at that same rate.
And just to be clear, people are not taxed on that first dollar at 70%. It progressive
right.
taxation is whatever, back when it was 90% or some odd in the Eisenhower years, you're not taxed 90% on the first $400,000. In other words, in today's dollars, $3 million. You're taxed after $3 million. The $3 million, you get whatever, you get the vast majority of that. And then after $3 million, back in the Eisenhower days, when America was really America, you'd get 10 cents on the dollar. Because you know what? Human beings, they don't need $4 million a year in pay. You can, and when you get, when that dude over there is getting $16 million a year and is not getting sufficiently taxed, that means that he buys that apartment for $8 million. And that means my apartment goes up by whatever, $500,000. That's what's going on there. So.
That's exactly right. And also, I just want to add, you know, to some of you had the 20 different congressionals. Did you get that from a list or something? I was just curious about that.
Yeah, I just
you said yes.
I had put it together from a couple of lists that other people had made, but some of those were definitely retiring as well. So,
yeah, I just want to add a couple more. I mean, one is the Texas 7th District, which had a 10-point lead in polling, John Culberson's district, Peter Roskam's district in Illinois, again, a Democratic lead by 10 points, Nebraska's 2nd District, which a Democrat won, up by 9 points, Texas 32nd District, Pete Sessions, a Democrat up by 5, Minnesota's 3rd, Democrat up by 2, Maine's 2nd, up by 1. So all of those have leads, and also all the people that you are talking about. So I also just want to just emphasize that, you know, I said this a few weeks ago, you know, people aren't really talking enough about mostly talking about California, New York, and Jersey and Illinois for some reason, right? But I mean, you know, if you look at other states like Oregon, the top tax state tax rate is 9.9%, Minnesota 9.85%, Iowa 8.98%. I mean, New York is actually 7th. And so, I mean, a lot of these states have, you know, fairly high state taxes if you are affluent. And so, you know, you're going to be losing a lot of money. And I think that people just haven't really considered that in all these other states. So I just also, even if you're in the 7 states that don't have a state income tax, you know, you're still going to be paying a lot more money on property taxes, which you're not going to be able to write off.
Right.
And so, I mean, you know, again, we can argue about, you know, whether that's good in the long run. But, I mean, I think we both agree that the taxation should be coming mostly from the top, you know.
Yep.
And so.
Yep. All right. Thanks, John.
So, all right. I support you all the way.
Appreciate it, man.
Great show.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Let's go to, you're calling from a 651 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
It's the Chris Lepaco.
The Chris Lepaco. The Chris Lepaco.
Hello. Hey, I just want to call and give my support to you today and let you know that, like, don't let these a-holes get you down, man. Like, you're on the right side of history, and this will all shake out, and people know that this is a disingenuous smear job that is being, what's the word I'm looking for?
Exploited.
Executed against you here.
Yes.
So. Cernovich put me on blast last night, so that was pretty fun, and I got to go back and forth with all of his supporters. And yeah, when you were saying that these are bots, I noticed that some of the accounts would like tweet me and do whatever, like threaten me or whatever. And then the account would disappear. It would like be deleted. So it was just another, more proof that, that it's not real people. But the real reason I called today is because there's a person, his name, let me see, Jimmy Reefer Cake. He is on Twitter, On H.A. Goodman's timeline. I'm in a little fight with H.A. Goodman right now.
Yeah, okay. Chris, I got a lot of people on the line. The last thing I want to do is go over the...
Oh, okay. Well, I just want to know why you're ignoring Jordan Sheraton, okay? That's all. You're ignoring Jordan Sheraton. That's all.
All right.
I guess
thanks.
That totally... All right, bye. Bye. Okay.
Bye. Am I ignoring Jordan Sheraton? He got fired? Calling from a 614 area code.
Hey, this is, excuse me, I got a cold. This is Steve in Columbus. And,
Hi, Steve.
I just wanted to call in. I had something out, but I've been with you since Air America days. I listened from day one. I listened to, the Break Room Live. And when you did I got right on, contributing to your show when you started this. And I just can't tell you how much you've done, for all these years through the Bush years and everything. And like, you've made work tolerable. You've made politics tolerable. And you just can't know the contribution you've really made to our lives. And especially with the libertarian callers, there's so few voices out there pushing back, and they have such an outsized representation on the internet. There's very few resources, to argue against them and beat them in their own game. And they're better than the average bear at debating, but they're not used to getting any pushback, and what you provide is so valuable, and that, it just breaks my heart that this is coming down on you this way. And I really support you. But one thing, what I wanted to talk about was last week you guys were talking about how it's difficult to talk about this tax bill, and it seems kind of abstract to the average person. But what we really lack on the left, and I'm not saying that the majority report should do this, but like, we don't have an echo chamber that can say things like this tax bill is, you're not going to be able to buy a house. Your taxes are going to go up. You're going to pay more in local and state taxes. I mean, we need... left-wing extremists, we should have a contingent of that to raise the alarm about this and not say, the measured sort of nuanced arguments against it. But we just need to say, like, hey, if you're buying a house, you're not going to be able to afford it.
I mean, it's there's less of an echo chamber than there was, back when we were doing Air America, frankly, because... radio is such an important part of it, and podcasts are fine, and we're reaching people through YouTube and podcasting, but it's not nearly the reach that it was when we were, had a potential audience of 2 or 3 million people at every quarter hour. And it's a problem. There's also, my understanding is that there was not a tremendous amount of funding to push back on this tax cut. Part of it is probably because those people who are going to be funding are, maybe it's not as urgent for them. The prospect of tax cuts are there, although I guess there's a certain demographic maybe one would expect to be more motivated in the coastal states. But I'm not sure. I mean, so I feel like someone could write a book on why there hasn't been the same mobilization against this tax bill. But I do think that it is... It is harder to express. I mean, because look, not everybody, it's going to be harder for you to buy a house. Yes, possibly. But if there's a deduction, I mean, $500,000, frankly, is probably not even enough to make houses more affordable. But if loans became...
That's true. But the right wing gets away with so much, and there's no pushback from reporters. They go out and
I agree with that.
We have Pizzagate in the news. We could have, just say this tax is going to raise your tax bill. It doesn't, it's not, you might get a $400 tax or something, but we just don't have, we're bringing knives, not even knives to a gunfight. We're bringing box cutters to gunfights.
Yep.
And this is part of why we're losing.
But
everyone's behind you, Sam. Stay strong.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for the call. Calling from a 710 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Oh, hello, Sam.
Hello.
Hello.
Are you calling from? Are you calling from a fish tank?
No, I'm calling from Fire RTC. You mentioned it yesterday.
Oh.
So
you gave me a chance to finally call in. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller. I'm calling from the beautiful country of Poland.
Poland?
First of all, I would... Yes.
Great.
So first of all, I would like to say that I appreciate what you did to our great national hero, Mr. Roman Polański. I don't have a daughter, but if I did, I would be honored if she was raped by a person like that. So yeah. Mike Serwatkowicz, if you're listening, that was satire. You moron. And yeah, the reason I'm calling is because my political views are kind of like your guys. I'm left-wing. I'm somewhere between a social democrat and a democratic socialist. And we have a problem here, not so different from the problem you had with your elections. Because we have a problem with strategic voting. We're currently ruled by a far-right party, and the biggest opposition party is a neoliberal one. And so yeah, the party that has the closest views to mine isn't the most popular one in Poland. It's around 4%, and
I'm sorry. I don't mean to rush you, but I think your computer microphone is making the quality of the call not great. But give me a quick comment, and then I got to go because I got a bunch of other callers. But I do appreciate your calling in.
Okay, sure. So I would just like to ask you: do you think I should be voting for a party that's left-wing but really socialist, but doesn't have a chance now to get into parliament? Or I should vote for a party that's neoliberal, but better than the right-wing one?
I mean, and I'll let you go and I'll answer. Thank you for the call. I mean, without knowing the specifics of Polish politics and your parliamentary system, I do not believe that there is a reason to vote for someone you believe is going to lose. I mean, I can.
There might be coalition opportunities in Poland, but
that's what I said. Like, I don't know the specifics, but broadly speaking, if you don't think that the act of voting is like turning on a light switch, if I want to turn on a light switch, I'm going to take the switch and I'm going to lift it up. I'm not going to go hit it sideways because I think like I'm going to be able to. Effectuate the way that people are going to make light switches. It is a vote is a tool, and you want it to have an outcome. If you want the right-wing party to win, then you vote for someone who will not beat them. If you don't want them to win, you vote for the entity that you think has the best chance to win. Are there exceptions? Yeah. I mean, if I'm in New York and I, am I going to vote for Chuck Schumer? No, I'm not going to because I know he's going to win. And then, maybe my vote will have a protest value. Maybe it won't, but it won't matter. But if I thought Chuck Schumer was going to lose to Carl Paladino, let's say, I would vote for Chuck Schumer. So that's the way that's my perspective on that.
Fear-based decision making.
It's total fear-based decision. Yeah. But I'll tell you something. In this era, ladies and gentlemen, you need to have fear because it doesn't matter if you're a media personality. Doesn't matter if you are a Seinfeld investor. It doesn't matter if you've taken people into your jacuzzi and poured acid on them. You're not safe. Listen to Steve Bannon and Sean Hannity explain.
I don't think they care about how good the country's doing. I think they're coming after Trump because they understand they have to destroy Trump, because to destroy Trump is not to destroy Trump, it's to destroy this movement. You know, they want to take that voice away from the forgotten man.
This is not about General Flynn. This isn't about Paul Manafort. They're just pawns in a...
Amen.
And, the ultimate goal
Andy McCarthy.
Pause it for one second. Pause it for one second. You guys are really profound thinkers. This is not about Paul Manafort. This is not about Mike Flynn. Yeah, no kidding. If it was about them, they wouldn't be getting plea deals. It's about someone else. Maybe it's about Papadopoulos. Maybe this is like Mueller's way to get to Papadopoulos. Or maybe it's trying to get to someone else.
Andy McCarthy had a great piece. This is about the impeachment of the president.
Yes.
No this doubt. Is not about Trump-Russia no collusion.
Guys, no. This is about a slow motion, steady effort to basically have a coup d'etat. Now, let's get Agreed. It done. Okay. That fight has got to be, because they will do, as you said about Levine, post-constitutional site.
It's a banana republic.
They're willing to destroy this country to keep control.
A banana
and it keeps the people out.
Okay, I say,
by the way, people like us may end up in jail. Let me tell you, they will stop at nothing. This is what I'm trying to get across to people. This is serious. This is the rule of law in this country now.
Amen.
Being
Amen.
Major test.
People like us may end up in jail. You know who might say something like that? Someone who's either A, super paranoid, or B, maybe in some way is implicated in something.
Next thing you know, you're going to look into what people do with their hot tubs and acid. Part of the impeachment of the president.
I mean, there is... I would be surprised if it has anything to do with Russia, but I wouldn't be surprised if it had anything to do with, like, maybe deals that involve, like, Turkey or maybe money laundering or who knows.
This is so deep. It's a deep state.
I just wonder, I mean, this is just an odd thing to say. People like us might end up in jail. I mean, I can understand why you're trying to rally the troops around you. But that sets a pretty high bar for them to come to your aid. Like, I could see, like, they're going to attack us. I don't know how they're going to come at us, but they're going to attack us.
Enraged alcoholics on TV could go to jail.
I mean,
could be coming.
They're going to go to jail for being white men, Sam.
They're so illegal. They're so white. They're illegal.
Stop talking about the plans. The fuck's the matter with you?
It is just a weird turn of phrase, because I could sit here and say, oh, Mike Cervantes is going to be so mad that he is going to try and attack me, you know, maybe in who knows in what ways. But who I would knows? Never say they're going to put me in jail. That's weird.
Yeah, that is pretty weird.
Unless, of course, I had done something criminal.
Or any number of possible criminal things.
Sadly, the President Show is on hiatus on Comedy Central because I suspect this would be a story that would be perfect for at least a moment on that show. McKay Coppins is reporting that apparently Mike Pence was just a little too excited.
Jump the gun, Mike.
A little too excited when the famous but apparently irrelevant to your Republican voter pussy grabbing tape came out.
And that goes, McKay, to one of the great anecdotes in your piece, that you write that Pence considered a coup in the days after the Access Hollywood tape. Coup, your word there. Yeah. So you write, within hours of the Post bombshell, Pence made it clear to the Republican National Committee that he was ready to take Trump's place as the party's nominee in the wake of the Access Hollywood tape. How did that play out exactly, and was he really ready to go?
Well, yeah, so this is one of the interesting things I learned. This is according to several Republicans who I talked to are familiar with the situation. It's been reported that he sent a letter to Trump saying that he needed to assess whether he could stay on the ticket. But my sources say that it went further than that. He, like you just read there, he made clear to the RNC he was ready to take the top of the ticket. And actually, during a meeting in the kind of chaotic 48 hours following the Access Hollywood tapes release, Trump met with some top advisors and Reince Priebus, who was then chairman of the RNC. And he actually said in that meeting, according to someone who was there, that Pence and Condoleezza Condoleezza Rice were ready to go in terms of taking over or forming a new Republican ticket.
Wow. Michael Steele.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought, McKay. So,
my old colleague, Michael Steele over at MSNBC, who doesn't want to dig into something like that. And Michael was, we were having a conversation about this clip. First off, is it any surprise? I mean, this is what Mike Pence turned to his wife, and in between the screen in which she's allowed to speak to him at her home, at their home, right? I mean, he has some type of like shroud over him. He turned to her and said, "Honey."
No, excuse me. Should he said wrong. He said, "Mother."
Mother. I have the opportunity to take this job. I would be working with one of the sleaziest human beings in the country, but maybe I might get a chance to be president, and at least, you know,
I could terrorize millions of women, Mother.
And I
could increase poverty and block voting access. Is it really such a horrible trade to work with an almost definite assaulter and rapist of women?
Did you see that new show on Hulu? We could achieve that.
We can do that, Mother. We don't just have to block black people from voting in Indiana.
And Mother. So it's easy to imagine that with Pence. The funny part is Michael Steele, nice guy. Michael Steele is transactional enough where he knows, like, oh, I don't want to get into this. I still have relationships in the Republican Party. I don't think he is simpatico with their belief system. I think it's just like, it's business.
I dig.
So I haven't known him that long at all, but.
Whoa, who was that?
That was Pence after the.
Oh my gosh. I didn't even remember.
That was around the same time.
Pence usually keeps his voice down when he's.
We got to race through some phone calls here. You call him from a 415 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Joseph of Marin, longtime listener, third time caller.
Joseph, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, well, first of all, three things, and I'll make it fast. One, I saw on Twitter you got all kinds of support from people, including Jimmy Dore.
Oh,
and yes, you should check your Twitter thing there.
Very nice.
And a whole bunch of other people that was pretty amazing to see. And I agree with them completely.
Appreciate that.
Last time I called, I mentioned Deutsche Bank as a possible linchpin to getting Trump for money laundering. It looks like it came out today in the news that Mueller subpoenaed Trump's Deutsche Bank records about 3 weeks ago.
That's huge in my mind.
And when I said that, everybody poo-pooed me and said, "Oh no, they'll never give it up." I said, "Oh no, he's made everybody so angry in Europe that even Merkel will say, yeah, give him everything."
Well, it looks like you're right. I mean, I guess we're going to find out more, but it's interesting. There is a sense, you know, whenever like you hear stuff like this, the way things are strategically leaked, it's almost as if, you know, we're being prepared for certain things to come out. And when we hear in the same day that it is reported that he has Trump's Deutsche Bank records, we hear Sean Hannity and Steve Bannon saying, like, this is about impeachment. It has nothing to do with collusion. In other words, they're going to get him on something else. And the... I don't know. You start to see these things floating around here. It's almost as if like there are bricks being placed on, a wall, and we're going to piece these together. And then all of a sudden you look up and you're like, wow, that looks a lot like a house.
I think that's exactly right. And the other thing is that this is like directly sending stuff to the White House to say, you know, get ready to maybe spend more time with Melania, or your
less time,
really
less
very
time.
Good, and you may want to leave.
Less time,
you know,
Melania,
like by March or April. You know,
I mean,
I know
my friend King Salman, Prince Salman, offered to behead her And I should have taken the opportunity. It was totally unfair.
One does wonder if, you know, and while I think it's impeachment is just not going to happen until unless it's like 2022, like I said, not in the first term anyways. That doesn't necessarily mean that Trump might not get the idea that like, oh, I think I'm tired of being president. I'm going to go now. In exchange for let's drop this whole thing. Let's get back to the business of making America great. That's the whole point. That's why I'm leaving.
First of all, it would be literally impossible to accomplish more. Secondly,
right.
Wasn't that
if we can all agree.
But isn't that what Sarah Palin said when she quit?
Literally
like, I can
Sarah
do
Palin
more
said.
For the state of Alaska by not that's being governor.
And now that Jared's in jail, I have my girlfriend back.
There we go.
Everything's great. Win-win for everyone.
Listen, I appreciate the call.
Can I hang out with Wu-Tang again? My contribution to your show, and it wouldn't take any of my information on
what?
Your...
We got to work on this. We got to do
you
a
check
fact.
You better
we'll send out an email,
check
I think.
Check your software. I think you might have been hacked, by the way, on your thing. I would be careful. Check your donations part on the Join the Majority Report site.
Okay, I will check in that. I appreciate the call. Thank you.
All right, take care. Thanks. Sam.
You were right. Best is left is best. You were right. Calling from a 478 area code. Who's this?
Well, hey, Sam, it's your favorite Southern Fried Super Fan, Jeff from Georgia.
it's the diffident, dissident peasant. What's happening, man?
Oh, not much, man. Sam, you're looking well-rested and flaccid today. It warms our hearts down here at the league. Your gig, it's over, man. This campaign to get you fired was incredibly clumsy and crude. And the board down here at the league strongly suspect it had more to do with your show hosting perspectives that are anti-war, anti-trust, anti-corruption, anti-capitalist. So we want to welcome you to the cheap seats down here for full-on flat-footed whiskey-drinking cornbread communism, man.
It sounds good.
All right, Sam. Well, hey, this war on Christmas and Mike Cernovich trolling ain't going to take care of themselves. I just want to let everybody know they need to support independent media. The Georgia Report is my favorite program. It's a favorite program of everyone I like and respect. Go Dawgs!
Appreciate the call, man. Thank you. Calling from a 917 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Is it me?
It sounds like it. Who's this?
Oh, hey. Hey, Sam, this is Christian from Brooklyn. I talk to Michael a lot on Facebook.
Okay.
So I've been a long time. I know. Well, he's more accessible than you are.
Well, he's very accessible. Now I'm going to have a lot of time.
Yeah. I'm going to feed him over to you now that you don't have MSNBC gigs anymore.
I was on the warpath on Twitter last night, as a lot of your fans were. And I just wanted to call in and, you know, voice my support for you, but also, you know, just to point out that, you know, I think you touched on this, but I just feel like all of cable television is lowering itself to the occasion that is Trump. And I felt this during the campaign last year when, you know, Melissa Harris Perry had her dispute and ultimately left MSNBC because they just kept showing, you know, footage of a dais where Trump may or may not eventually speak for hours on end instead of her show, which actually had like queer, poor people, you know, marginalized people on it that actually, you know, could speak for themselves and tell their stories. And I think it was probably, you know, next to Chris's Hayes' old show or in league with it, the weekend show was, you know, one of the best things that happened on cable television in a really long time.
Yep.
And so I kind of have to admit, like, I kind of started to turn against MSNBC then. And then, like, I just feel like they all played such a role in helping normalize Trump in the lead up to the election that they really helped him get elected. And I just think that we need to support your podcast. I support a number of podcasts. I, you know, support Michael's, but also like, you know, even like the Stephanie Miller show, which is more centrist, but you know, we need you know, these alternative media, because the corporate media is not going to do it. And I do agree with the caller earlier that said, like, we are bringing a box cutter to a gunfight. You know, they are so disciplined, and the Kochs and all them will just wash people like Mike Brnovich in so much money that it's really difficult to compete.
Yes.
And the thing of it is that people are on our, you know, are on our side. The majority of people, if they were told the reality of something like this tax bill, they would be on our side. But you have to cut through so much to get to your audience. And, you know, I run a nonprofit. That's what I do. And, you know, a lot of things that even used to be free for nonprofits to, like, get the word out on our behalf, like Facebook and stuff, they've found ways to make it expensive.
Right.
Because everything is monetized and everything, there's a fee to do anything at this point. And, you know, even just the free half of your show, like, I was telling a friend about, you know, what was going on when we were walking our dogs the other day. And I said to her, I was like, this is one of the few shows, like, you can actually, like, learn about what's going on in Uganda and, you know, like, and actually have your eyes and your ears and your knowledge expanded and opened. And so I really do want to, like, just thank you guys. And you know, I think it's great that you guys are stepping up. I gave to your GoFundMe. Definitely, you know, I don't have a ton of money, but, you know, I will definitely stay with you guys. You know, and really just hope that, you know, that people do respond to us in a way that says we're gonna take people like Cernovich down.
Yeah.
And my other question about Cernovich is like, first of all, if he has $50,000 a month from his ex-wife, why can't he get his teeth fixed?
That's a great question. Maybe we can ask him. I appreciate the call.
Maybe he could have his eyes separated, something. I mean, he's supposed to be like a hot guy, but he's actually like somebody's caricature of a hot guy.
We'll clip that, but maybe anyway, for the documentary.
Not my ex-wife.
Appreciate the call. All right, folks. I'm sorry. We're going to have to go through these quick. I want to say hello to everybody on the line, but we're going to have to do it quick because I got to get out of here in about 10 minutes. So quickly, you call from a 215 area code. Who's this? Give me one sentence. 215. Okay. Calling from a 330 area code. Who's this? Got to be quick.
It's Richard. Do I get two sentences since the last one blew you off?
That's one.
I kicked in some more money via Patreon, so that's a good thing.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you.
Now, one other thing I want to point out, I don't know if anybody's mentioned it yet. There's a really good, albeit kind of depressing and thought-provoking article on Slate right now called What We Talk About When We Talk About Donald Trump. And it raises the question of innocent versus not-so-innocent collaboration with all the right-wing movements we're seeing across the country. And it's really worth reading, and it's really worth you know, making people think, as opposed to just saying, "Oh no, that's awful."
All right,
you know,
we got to
figure out how to respond.
All right, great. We got it up on the thing. Thank you, Richard. And he was good about keeping it short there. Calling from a 215 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Two sentences.
Sam, hi, it's Mindy.
Mindy,
can you hear me?
Yes, Mindy, I can hear you.
Okay. All I want to tell you is that my tweet that I tweeted about you, this is very important. The tweet that I tweeted about you went viral yesterday. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. The tweet went viral, but it didn't go viral with bots or anything. I mean, I was looking at all the people that were tweeting me. They were like movie stars, people with blue check marks, Billy Baldwin, all these feminist groups, people, like really important people. I mean, mid-level important people were like retweeting my tweet. I have like 1,100 retweets on it, but the thing, it's not even about my tweet. It's about that we opened up our eyes about Cernovich. People are tweeting me all kinds of information about him. They're sending me links, and they're sending me, because people are pussies and they won't put it up themselves. They want me to do it. He blocked me.
Oh, Mike.
He blocked me,
blocked.
Like, on Thursday
Mindy's
night.
Mindy's blocked.
Yeah, he did a lot of blocking.
A middle-aged woman.
He did a lot of blocking.
Middle-aged women are very powerful.
He did a lot of blocking. He blocked me the other day.
Blocked.
I've never tweeted at him.
He blocked me. He's got a new a Twitter account. I'll retweet it again to you.
Okay.
You can get them there if you want. But we're going to take this bastard down. And don't worry about MSNBC. People are like, everybody I know, people are not watching it. It got really bad. Chris Hayes looks like a deer in the headlight. I mean, they're all scared about getting fired. I'm not watching it anymore. I hate Joe Scarborough. Michael, I saw the light. I drank the light. I'm there.
Awesome.
Okay. And wait, now I have nothing to do at 7 o'clock since I'm better. I have nothing to do because I'm not watching MSNBC, and I will watch your show tonight for the first time, and I will join.
Mindy, amazing call. What?
That's great, Mindy.
I saw the light.
Thank you so much for all the Twitter. I saw
seriously,
much
that was
your
awesome.
Compilations were getting passed.
Mindy, you're like a great researcher. You like got so much. I mean, I knew the guy was a scumbag, but I didn't know the half of what you dug up. It was amazing.
Okay, I must tell you this. I have to do this. My husband is the scumbag. Well, I'm the one that got the scum. My husband went on it like crazy. My husband, a major researcher, he went crazy on it. And he told me what I'm allowed to tweet, what I'm not allowed to tweet legally.
That is a very good idea.
That is good.
That's a great idea. That's suffering Thuckatash.
So we all have to give a shout out to my husband, Kevin, because he
thank
is remarkable.
Kevin.
Shout out, Kevin. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mindy. I really appreciate it.
We love you, Sam.
Thank you, Mindy.
Don't worry about it, Sam. We're on it.
Thank
you. We're on you. We've got you.
I got to tell you, honestly, it was like, did I say this already? It was like attending your own funeral. It was.
I get that, actually.
I mean, honestly.
No, you didn't.
It was like, I don't tend to get that weepy, but I felt weepy at times. It was like, oh, my God. I mean, people were tweeting and emailing.
It's very surreal to be scrolling through Twitter and every like fourth tweet is about the show.
I was looking at the thing and I'm like, am I on my notifications? No, that's in. But it was also, I got very, very sweet messages from listeners, from people in the community. I mean, really, really nice stuff. So sometimes they were so nice that I thought like, this has got to be O'Keefe. Just like fishing around for something. Maybe that was just a function of...
Hi, I was a previous victim of a Sam Cedar tweet.
Calling from a 212
no,
area code.
No, I don't want to talk about it.
I'm calling from
now.
A 212 area code. Got to be quick.
Hello?
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 Hello? Hey, Sam. Hey.
Yeah, got to be quick.
Sorry, I'll be really quick. I just got back from a month in Puerto Rico last night, and I was... interested to talk to you guys about it a little bit. The other thing was there is a fundraiser on Thursday that I bought some tickets for you guys to attend. And if I email you at Majority Reporters, I could pass that along if you want.
That would be great. Will you do this? Call in tomorrow or Thursday when we can have some time to hear about what's going on there. All right. Thank you so much.
One other thing you want to hear.
Yeah.
One other thing. That inappropriate joke that these Air America executives told at that bar one time, I was the fourth guy in that conversation with you, and I can prove it.
You were the fourth guy in that car? No, you weren't.
I was.
Did you work at Air America?
No. I'm an architect. We just met that night. It was just a complete happenstance. But yeah, I was sitting there with you that day. And I wanted to mention this to you at some point. I called before to say that and just finally. Anyways, so if we see you on Thursday, I'll fill you in on that.
Okay, great. Wow, that's weird.
All right, I'll call back tomorrow.
Okay. I don't remember there being a fourth guy. But I remember he would have to have been the fifth guy.
Who was the fourth guy?
Calling from a 415 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Got to be quick.
This is H. Ross Perot from Texas. Now, let me just say this about Coco Bitch. You know, the man is more slippery than a pocket full of pudding. You know, we got a saying here in Texas, a worm is the only animal that can't fall down. You know, I mean, the man thinks he's as smart as a trio full of hootie owls, but he's really dumb as a barrel of hair.
All right.
Thank you, Ross. You just got to know.
Thanks, buddy. Calling from a 360 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Got to be quick.
Hey, Sam.
Yeah.
I'm from Olympia. So real quick, first off, there's a really great article on Slate right now called Alt-Right Women Are Upset.
Okay. Salon.
Alt-Right Men Are Treating
Salon.
Them Terribly.
Okay. All right. I'll check that out.
Salon. Sorry. It's. I feel like Jamie would really like it. Second, I think rather than doing a documentary, you should do some kind of speech therapy for Mike Cernovich.
Interesting, interesting idea, but I wouldn't want him to be a better communicator. Appreciate the call. We'll check out that piece. A call from a 585 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Sam. This is Rebecca from Boonville.
Hi, Rebecca.
I just want to let you know that, hey, send all of our love and support. I just ordered my sheets from Brooklinen and let them know I'm a majority supporter and I appreciate them. And I also wanted to send my love to Jamie. Condolences. Hey, we love you guys so much and fight the good fight and get those bastards.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the call. All right, we got three more callers. Calling from a 626 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Sam, Michael in Ohio.
Michael, what's on your mind?
I got one thing, a couple things for you on Cernovich. Number one, do you think he watches reruns of Chuck Liddell MMA bouts to treat his erectile dysfunction?
I don't know, but that's the only question I
can't
answer.
Confirm or deny.
I
see the direction you're going in.
Do you think he freehands photo pictures of Tweety Bird in a bikini?
I'm not even sure I know what that means. Colin from a 443 area. Yes, I think
I'll be more indulgent.
I think Michael
that sort
will be enjoying that for an hour and a half. Colin, 443 area code. Who's this?
Sam, this is Anthony from Baltimore.
Anthony, what's on your mind?
I'm just calling in to say, I got to re-up on my membership. I'm going to email you guys about it, so I don't know how to go about re-upping, but I'm going to email you guys. And I just want to say, you know, I love y'all. You guys equip and activate your listeners like me to make a difference in the world while giving us comedic relief in the process, and that's what it's all about, man. And, you know, I love what you guys do, and I got my family making donations, and you guys are the best. You guys
Thank you, Anthony.
Are awesome.
Appreciate
it. Keep doing what you're doing, man.
Thanks for calling. All right, the final call of the day. Thank you again, Anthony. Calling from an 814 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Sam. This is Greg from the North Coast. I'm really sympathetic with what happened to you. It happens to most of us as we get pushed out. In my case, they used a disability and over-education to get me out. And years later, what I found out was speaking truth to those that sign your paycheck, there's a lot of people that are hiding behind exactly what you were saying. There's a lot of people that don't have the courage to speak that truth. And what you find out years later is that fear was predominant. Fear by those who got rid of you and fear by those that were participating in the situation with you. So take it as a compliment, Sam. Well, they feared you.
I appreciate
that. I'm with you, and I'm going to sign up as soon as I can. So.
Hang
I appreciate all the work you do. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thanks for the call. All right, folks. I'm sorry we don't have time for any other callers. Good. God, I don't like that new interface.
What a nifty little cocktail for little Samantha.
All right, we're going to do...
Only one Rachel left on MSNBC now. All the heartache.
We'll do 10 more, 10 IMs. Uchi Wally, still with you, Sam. Proud longtime member. Thanks, man. Reklameka, you're a bot. You're a bot. You're a bot, you're a bot, you're a bot, you're a bot, you're a bot. And Lewis, callers mentioning libertarians. You know who I missed? Jim from PA. What happened? Did he finally commit seppuku with the sharp end of an American Express gold he couldn't pay off with Bitcoin? Contagious chameleon. Sam, Bernie running around the country railing against GOP tax bill, mentioning the deficit increase several times. I think this is a political gamble he's making, given that Kelton was his campaign economic advisor. She worked on the banking committee. I'm pretty sure he knows the deficits don't matter. I think what he knows is that if he wins, he's going to need a lot of momentum behind a huge tax increase on the rich. I believe he's going to leverage a large majority of people who believe the deficit is the problem and use that to propose wealth redistribution. I love Sarah Palin. First off, F. Mike Cernovich and the alt-right claim. Majority Report listeners came equipped with the game. He can't claim to be an alpha male, but he eats off his ex-wife. Once Matthew drops the film, he'll be F for life. Sam, going to hit him up. Serious note, Time is going to release their Person of the Year issue, Honest Opinions. We don't have time for that. Sorry. Jonathan Armstead, Sam, congrats on phrasing the departure as mutual decision. You're like me. All my firings have been mutual decisions. They sit me down, tell me that I'm let go, and I agree to get up and walk away. John McCain's brain tumor. Sam, I did some asking around, and I am hearing that two unnamed NBC executives have one of me, a.k.a. brain tumor. So, yeah, it's sad, but it explains the poor decision-making. The real BS in the whole thing, truly unbelievable part, is the headshot of you accompanying the original story in the rap. How old is that thing? A decade? Tell me about it. Great leap forward. Every time Shostakovich's wife has sex. Is it satire? I don't know who that is. Left is European, true solidarity, the way of the future in America, Europe, Bernie Sanders 2020, in U.S., Varoufakis, and DM25 is running in 2019 for European Union Parliament elections. Joseph Ballin, Cernanovich, blocked me on Twitter. I guess he didn't want a free and open exchange of ideas. Boycott MSNBC is now trending hashtag on Twitter. Wow. Leon Gittins, hi. Sam, here's the link to the Facebook where we're trying to organize the biggest demonstration in UK history. Trump comes over here. Watch this space. I will post this. That's Twitter. Oh, okay. It goes to Owen Jones' Twitter. We'll post it. Jake from Indiana. Why does it seem, though, media is so sensitive to critique from the right compared to the left? Indeed, International Herald Sam is more glorifying pedophiles than producers was glorifying Nazis. Barham Sir Novich. Repeat 10 times. Make sure you know how to say it correctly, then promptly forget and proceed to call him Rapist Mike from now on. Flippy Joe, can't listen live today, but want to say thank you for all you do. I'm angry and frustrated and honestly depressed right now. Don't be. They are not winning, which just means that we're going to be able to do more fun things. Keep up the good work, says Kay. Sam, sending support from San Francisco, works for the government and can never listen live or call in. How can I help with the documentary? We will give you more information going forward. Starting a DSA chapter in Boise. I know there are a few listeners from this area. Check out Boise DSA on Twitter, at Boise DSA on Twitter. Check it out, folks, says Larry Craig's hairy leg. And the final IM of the day. Jimmy Durr. So glad you people are standing with you. I put a little towards the GoFundMe. I've been listening since almost day one and remember how miserable it was when the show went away. Keep it up. But I get the feeling you are nuts and might disagree with a certain someone who said the Flynn plea deal was a huge win for Trump. Yeah, it could be bad, but the moon could also fall into Lake Michigan. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot somewhere the choice was made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.